Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Thursday morning MV Pro call. Today is December 9th, and I'd like to welcome those of you that are here live as well as those of you listening to this via recording, which of course you can do by subscribing to MotiVitality on whatever podcast application you happen to use or by going to MotiVitality.com where you can listen to years and years and years worth of archives. Gonna do things a little differently today because we do have a special guest with us today. So we will skip the questions that we normally have, the discussion we normally have at the very beginning, so that we can take some time and talk to our guests. So our guest today, we're very excited to have a gentleman named Stephen Lawn, who is a project engineer at D&B Engineers and Architects, and he works with a local municipality on Long Island, okay, and had an opportunity. We've talked about the group that one of our MV Pros and I went to a few weeks ago where we had an opportunity to brush shoulders with some young professionals in the water treatment industry, specifically on the municipal water treatment side, and wanted to have Stephen on to kind of talk about some of those perspectives and some of the conversations that we had. Stephen has a bachelor's and a master's in environmental engineering, and he holds what's a PE license, Stephen? What is that?
Professional engineering license.
Oh, professional engineering license in the state of New York. He's got experience in hydraulic modeling and design and supervision of the construction of well stations, GAC plants, packed tower aeration systems, advanced oxidation treatment systems, and nitrate treatment systems. He's also very active in the American Water Works Association and the Long Island Water Conference, where he serves as chair of the Young Professionals Committee. So, Stephen, I first off want to just say thank you very much for taking your time and talking to us. You and I talked a little bit ahead of time, and I want to get into here in just a few minutes just the different perspectives of your side of the industry and our side of the industry, but let's start a little bit with your background. And you know, you and I were just talking about, you know, my history a little bit before we came in. I'm curious, when you were coming up through elementary school and high school, was it your dream to work at in the municipal water treatment industry? I mean, how did you find yourself doing this for the last decade and a half?
So it's interesting. And thank you for having me on, Kelly, because this is a good opportunity. No, I don't think anyone comes up through elementary school and high school knowing they want to do municipal water treatment. I mean, if they do, great for them, but I don't think that tends to be the way. My father was a land surveyor, and I learned land surveying from a young age. I was doing it freelance for years and years while I was in high school. So I knew I wanted to do something along those engineering, surveying type lines. You know, originally I was planning on going into civil engineering, you know, construction, you know, designing buildings, all that sort of thing. And I got to some of my first classes at Manhattan College, and they had a fantastic thing where you get, in your freshman year, first semester, you get a couple weeks trying each of the different engineering branches. And I found I didn't really like civil all that much, but I did like the environmental engineering, which was the water and wastewater treatment end of things. So it was basically at that point that I decided to make the switch and go full on into the water, wastewater end of things.
So it's been kind of a good time for you to be in that because, I mean, you've been doing it for a while, and infrastructure has been in the news for years.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and obviously,
yeah.
And water being a major part of that. And I know that you agree that, you know, when a lot of people, they hear about infrastructure, they hear about the roads and bridges and you know, and
yep.
This is something that you and Lily and myself and a couple other people that you work with or mingle with, we're talking about that. that really, from our perspective, I mean, many times our underground water delivery systems are 3 and 4 times older than our roads and bridges. So
exactly.
Great time
and,
for you to go ahead. Go ahead. I want.
Yeah, and no one
that,
and so. No one generally thinks of the underground stuff when they're looking at aging infrastructure or even the infrastructure that's there. No one really thinks about the pipes below their feet.
Yeah. So how has that impacted what you do, or you know how you go about your business, or the treatment plans that you guys have?
Well, especially on Long Island, where Long Island, New York, where I work, the municipalities are dealing with such a shortage of land. You know, they have properties that they've had since they were incorporated back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and haven't really expanded property-wise past then. And property values on Long Island have just gone through the roof. And suburbia has encroached on all of the municipal lands. So when it comes to designing and building new treatment for these compounds and chemicals that are becoming, you know, regulated and that we have to then remove, we're having to be very creative with how we go about designing treatment systems to fit on postage stamp-sized properties, because these are not small treatment systems. And on the other side of things, you know, there's all of this cast iron pipe and ductile iron pipe from the, you know, again, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s that never got changed out, never got replaced. And a lot of municipalities are going through it slowly, but most of it is just patch jobs where they're fixing breaks as they come. You know, they're not going into large-scale replacements of that pipe that's reaching the end of its useful life.
So let me, before we start going down that road, because there obviously are challenges, right? There's
sure.
Political challenges and the land challenges and stuff like that. But let me take a minute kind of and have you, because what I don't want to have happen from this call, this is something you and I spoke about yesterday in preparation, is for the listeners on this call to walk away and go, oh, municipalities, you know, look at the challenges they have. So let's take a second and I'd love to hear your perspective of my side of the industry, the point of view, point of entry side of the industry. What's your experience with it, and what's your opinion of how our two branches of the same industry should be interacting with each other?
Sure. So, you know, while I mentioned, you know, that we have these challenges, we still go out and, you know, find our way about those challenges. We do, you know, come to the point where all of the water that leaves any of the drinking water treatment plants on Long Island, you know, as it leaves the plant, meets every state, federal, and local regulation. And being in New York, you know, it varies state by state, but being in New York, we're some of the strictest drinking water treatment regulations in the nation. So we come to a point where, you know, whatever treatment needs to be installed, we install it. We make sure that we're delivering water that is safe to drink, that meets all of the regulations as it leaves the treatment plant. Likewise, we make sure that, you know, all of the water is chlorinated to protect against any biological contamination. Not that that's as much of a problem on Long Island, but it is a problem in other areas. But that's why we add the chlorine. We protect against that, which also, to a degree, would protect against any biological attack were that to happen. Which is one of the reasons Department of Homeland Security has required it. Now, you know, we have, given that, again, I know my area more than others, but Long Island had a lot of aeronautic and military industry back in World War II, Vietnam, Korea, which led to some contamination of the groundwater with various volatile organics, nitrates, the compounds that people are all in the news right now with the perfluorinateds, PFOA, PFOS, and 1,4-dioxane. So there are challenges, but we do install treatment for each of those wherever they appear. And we treat down to non-detect, which would be an effective zero for each of those contaminants. Nitrates, we treat to about a 5 milligram per liter, which is well below the 10 MCL. And then iron, which is in some wells on Long Island, down towards the South Shore primarily, we treat to, again, keep it well below the MCL, but with something like that, there may still be aesthetic concerns, you know, still some coloration of the water. You know, we use a variety of different treatment technologies. GACs are prevalent. We have them all over the place. They're great for removing the perfluorinateds. They're great for removing a lot of the different VOCs. I imagine some people in your industry are quite familiar with granular activated carbon. And then we also use packed tower aeration systems, which uses air to remove various volatiles. You pass air up through water that comes down, and it just rips the volatiles right off of the water. More recently, we've been using advanced oxidation treatment to remove 1,4-dioxane, which is a very hard to remove compound, but advanced oxidation does the trick. Uses UV light and peroxide to create hydroxyl radicals, which basically just blast the 1,4-dioxane molecules apart. And it's indiscriminate, so it will destroy other contaminants you may have at the same time. And then you just have to use a GAC afterwards to remove any of the excess peroxide you may have. So that's generally the state of things here. And the way we tend to see the other side of it, where you're doing the point of use, is we don't, us and the municipalities don't particularly appreciate any fear-mongering about the water. Like I said, the water, as it leaves our plants, is 100% safe to drink, meets every regulation, including all of the stricter ones that New York State has. However, if it's approached from the side of the aesthetics, hey, I don't like the smell of chlorine in the water. I don't like the taste of it. Removal of that, that's fine to me. Using that as an endpoint to get people, you know, to use point of use treatment, that's great. Iron, we don't remove iron down to a point where it's not visible. Similar with manganese. Remove it to the point where it's safe, but not where it's not necessarily an aesthetic concern. Likewise, in areas that have hardness issues, which we don't particularly hear, but like my sister lives in Arizona, they have a hardness issue. Water softeners are a fantastic thing in those cases.
So, you know, we in our industry, we refer to the point-of-use, point-of-entry technology as final barrier. And one of the ways that I usually encourage people to talk about it is one of the phrases that we often say is we make good water great, meaning, you know, you guys, that your side of the industry gets it there to, I mean, it's impossible to get it to the level that my side of the industry can get it at a mass rate.
Sure.
I mean, you guys have the technology to do it. But then the water still does have to travel through the delivery systems. And
of
so
course.
what I recommend our side of the industry do is it's just peace of mind. It's a final barrier. It takes what you have done. You make our job way, way easier to treat, because if somebody starts directly from a well and they've got 4 parts per million of iron, as opposed to half a part per million of iron. You know, suddenly what you've done as a pretreatment makes it way easier. I always believe, and maybe you'll tell me whether or not you agree, I think our two industries should be working together, not against each other, not fear-mongering, not bashing each other, but actually working in partnership, hand in hand.
I certainly agree with that. You know, we want people to drink the tap water. You know, whatever helps someone get to that point is a good thing. But fear-mongering about the tap water is self-defeating in a way.
What would you say as an example? I mean, have you run across that from our side of the industry? You know, what do people say or do that you would consider fear-mongering?
So when people find out I work in this industry, the first question they ask me is the water safe to drink? And some of those people have, you know, have heard from ones who've come through and said, you know, come through with a pool testing kit and said, your pH is wrong. Your chlorine, you've got chlorine in your water, as if that's something that shouldn't be there. And as if the pH being, you know, somewhere in the, you know, high sevens is a bad thing. And that's why you need a in-home treatment system. And they'll come and ask me, is this actually a bad thing? And I'll say, no, you know, this is what it is. Look, chlorine, it's a taste and odor thing. I get it. I don't particularly care for it. And if you want something that'll remove that and make it more palatable to you, fantastic. But don't say that it's bad.
What about THMs, trihalomethanes? And I'm asking that just out of curiosity, because the way I have always heard, and I'm hoping, remember I told you about the, there would be no gotcha questions, but this is,
sure.
I'm just a, so I hope that you don't take this as this at all, because
No.
I'm absolutely curious and want to be educated myself on this, okay? So what I have learned about chlorine is that since we started introducing chlorine into our water supply, death and illness from microbiological contamination in this country dropped to almost non-existent. I mean, you hear about it periodically because it doesn't happen that often. It's like a plane crash. You know, it makes news because it generally doesn't happen. But the analogy that I have heard is, you know, it's a lot like a loaf of bread, where the loaf of bread comes in a plastic wrapper to keep dirt and grime and stuff like that from, you know, until it gets to the house. But once it gets to the house, you take the bread out of the plastic. And there are, you know, disinfection byproducts, trihalomethanes and, you know, and so what about that? Now, I agree with you 100% when there are companies out there that stick their fingers in water and talk about that, and they put apples, and there's this all this magic show stuff really designed to, that's completely inaccurate. Chlorine's a gas, and it begins to dissipate into the air as soon as you aerate the water. I mean, and so those little demonstrations are very misleading, and I completely disagree with them. But is there some validity to removing the chlorine once it, you know, once it's done its job on its way to the home?
Sure. And, you know, it from my end of things, again, since I work mostly on Long Island, we're unique in that we have a very good deep aquifer system. There's little to no organic carbon in the raw water that we pump up. Unlike areas with surface waters like New York City, where basically what happens is the humic material, the organic carbons, are what mix with chlorine to create disinfection byproducts. So we have very low prevalence of disinfection byproducts right in our particular area. But once you move to anywhere that's dealing with the surface water, that becomes a much bigger issue. I think I may have told you that when I was in college, I worked in an environmental lab doing research during my grad school time on chloramines, And New York City had been at the time thinking of introducing chloramines as treatment as opposed to chlorine. And we found that that had a much higher incidence of creating disinfection byproducts, so they obviously did not go with it.
For sure.
But yes, I fully support in areas where you're dealing with a surface water where disinfection byproducts are an issue, removing the chlorine. And even in the area where I am, I fill a glass bottle with water, leave a little headspace in it, and put it in the fridge because I know by the time I go to drink it, the chlorine will have dissipated out and, you know, I'll have cold water as a bonus. But for those who want to have point-of-use treatment for that, I don't disagree with that as a thing.
Yeah. What about fluoride? I know Long Island, your area, does not add fluoride to water, but you know, as opposed to the city does, I believe they put fluoride in. And but there's such a controversy. You know, what's your, and this is probably just an opinion for you, but
sure.
What's your opinion as, you know, somebody on that side of the industry? Why the controversy over fluoride, and what's your personal opinion of it? Now, and by the way, recognizing that you do not represent any entity
when you
have that,
right.
So I'm just curious. So
honestly, this is a hard question for me because since we don't work with it personally in my industry, my only exposure to it was in college with discussions about it. So I'm not up on any of the latest research. I'm not up on anything like that. And like I said, none of our clients use it. So I'm not as familiar with it, but, you know, given that currently most, dentists will apply a topical fluoride treatment, which they say is, you know, equally as good as having it in the water, I'm generally opposed to adding things to the water if we don't have to.
I'm 100% in agreement with you on that. I mean, not for all the reasons. I went to a thing down in Florida. I had an opportunity to present in front of a discussion, a little council discussion, and I'm anti-fluoride for the same reasons that you said, not for any of the conspiracy stuff or anything else. And even though, and I know the evidence is out there that tooth decay has dropped and there's a lot of controversy, but somebody stood up there, I swear, and said that the United States was adding fluoride to the water because it was an ingredient of Prozac and they wanted to subdue us. So when we came to take away our guns, we wouldn't fight back. And I mean, it was the craziest stuff. I wish I could make it up. I would say I was making it up, but somebody actually stood up there publicly and said that. It was crazy. But we've got a couple minutes here, and you have an opportunity not only to the few people that are on here live, but also to the 100 or more that will be listening to this over the next couple of weeks. What would you like to say to my side of the industry? If you could get us into a room, that's basically what this is, Stephen, to get, set us down and tell us what we need to know about what we're doing on a daily basis.
So, like you said, and like, you know, like we've said in the discussion here, I'm not opposed to point of use. Generally, our industry isn't in principle. We understand that, you know, we're putting out water that, while it's entirely safe and meets all of the guidelines, may still have things like there's a certain level of iron that we don't remove. There's a certain level of nitrate that we don't remove. We remove down to where we have to, usually well below the MCL, but not to a zero on certain things because it would be simply impractical. We add chlorine. And in the areas that have surface water, disinfection byproducts can arise from that. We don't soften the water in areas where that is an issue. So for all of those reasons, those are all fantastic, legitimate reasons for point of use. And we appreciate that if someone is, you know, getting a point of use treatment like that and is then drinking their tap water and using their tap water when they wouldn't have otherwise, that's a good thing. And if things are approached like that, that's great. The fear-mongering is what we don't like. We don't like when people are told that the water coming out of our treatment is not safe or has contaminants based on either some, you know, like you said, magic show, or based on taking the raw water data, which is something I've seen and heard of before, and presenting that as if that is the water coming to you, whereas it's certainly not. And again, at least in New York, all water suppliers have to provide a yearly summary of what their water treatment has been and what the level of things coming to you is. But that said, you know, if you're not approaching it from a fear-mongering standpoint, if you're not approaching it, if you're more approaching it from this is, like you said, that extra belt and suspenders, that extra making it perfect as opposed to just good or great, you know, or safe. Safe to amazing, that's good. We like that. We appreciate that because that'll get more people to drink their water rather than buy bottled.
I like that. Safe to amazing. That's actually pretty good. So it's the starting point becomes safe. It's already safe.
Right.
I like that a lot. Hey, you know, when you talk about the fear mongering, you know, there's a lot of that comes in the media too, right?
Yes.
I mean, how do you guys?
100%.
I mean, that's probably where it starts in many cases, because people in my industry take a newspaper or, you know, an article or something and use that. So how do you combat that?
It's very difficult. It's one of those things where, you know, we get up there, and at least for the water conference, we always provide a rebuttal to any article, and we make ourselves available to any article that comes out, at least in any of the local publications. But it's put on equal bearing with someone who's not necessarily an expert talking about how something's dangerous.
Yeah, got to be frustrating as heck.
It is. But all we can do is keep putting our message out there that the water is safe, that we're doing everything we can to treat it. You know, and like I said, you know, the more people who trust their water, who are willing to drink the tap water, that's all a good thing as far as we're concerned.
So we have 2 minutes left here. Any questions for Stephen, from anybody on listening in? Stephen, any final thoughts here before we finish up?
I think we about covered it, and thank you very much for having me on. We, from my side in industry, we really appreciate having this opportunity to basically, you know, help the relationship between your side and our side.
Yeah, I really think it needs to be bridged. I wish that there were more opportunities for us. I mean, but I think that, you know, we had talked about this, that we enter into these discussions sometimes with a chip automatically. And it's, I honestly think that that's been more due to my side of the industry, because we traditionally have gone in and used those scare tactics and the fear mongering. For years we did that, and I really think that it does long term harm. So I appreciate you joining us and having the conversation as well. I have really enjoyed all the conversations we've had, and look forward to more in the future. So. Everybody,
of
thank
course.
You very much.
Jen,
go ahead, Jen.
I was muted when I was earlier. So Stephen, I also let you know how much I appreciate that you jumped on, because unfortunately you are correct. There are a lot of people that don't understand the hard work that goes into making safe water. And, you know, I also, and I'm going to totally steal it, just so you know, when I'm speaking and talking about municipal water, I'm going to steal the making safe water great, because that's...
Oh, please do.
That's what you do. I'll give you total credit for it, too. But thank you so much. Thank you for coming on. We really do appreciate it.
Oh, thank you guys
for having me. One more call of the year. We will have this call next week. Actually two more, I guess. We have two more, it looks like. But so we will see all of you next week, if not before. Stephen, thank you again. And everybody else, be safe. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.